Today is Wednesday, the 3rd of June, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Millard, Washington. As images of violent protests cascade across television screens, many opt for more peaceful measures.
As a believer, really grieves me the most is that in a nation that claims to be Christian, that these things really misrepresent God's character.
Plus, why police reform is difficult in the United States despite decades of work.
It consists of 18,000 local law enforcement agencies, which means you have 18,000 philosophies, 18,000 cultures.
We'll have those stories and more next. Protests in the United States continued Tuesday night in cities all over the country as people continued to express anger and frustration at the death of George Floyd while in police custody. Most of the gatherings were peaceful. The protesters defied curfew orders in some areas, including in New York City, where hundreds of people remained on the Brooklyn Bridge late into the night after marching from the Brooklyn side to find their path into Manhattan blocked by police. In Atlanta, police fired tear gas to break up a crowd of hundreds who remained after the start of the city's 9 p.m. curfew. Officers were seen detaining people in both cities. Hundreds of people remained past curfew time in Washington's Lafayette Square Park across from the White House. The scene was much quieter than the day before when officers aggressively pushed largely peaceful protesters out to clear the way for President Donald Trump to make an appearance in front of nearby St. John's Church. A Reuters Ipsos poll released on Tuesday showed 64% of adults in the United States were, quote, sympathetic to people who are out protesting right now, end quote, compared to only 27% who were not and 9% who were unsure. The same poll showed 55% of the people disapproved of the way that President Trump had been handling the situation, compared to about one-third who said they approved. Images of violence and looting have dominated news coverage of America's protests against racism and police brutality, but most people participating in the demonstrations have not taken part in the mayhem. VOA's Jesusumi Oni has more on how people are making themselves heard without violence.
An emotional visit to the site where it all began. The brother of George Floyd at a makeshift memorial where a white Minneapolis police officer kneeled on his brother's neck, calling for calm and peace in the wake of widespread unrest that has unfolded since Floyd's death.
Let's switch it up, y'all. Let's switch it up.
Yes. Amen.
Do this peacefully, please.
With U.S. cities in flames following the most widespread protest over police brutality and racism in decades, demonstrators worry their calls for justice are being drowned out by the violence.
George Floyd was killed like an animal, and we're tired. This is the norm. This is not something that's new. It's actually something that's been going on. It's been happening. And we're here just to say that we're tired of this.
The rallies are made up mainly of peaceful demonstrators who greatly outnumber those who want to instigate violence. Yet a number of protests have descended into chaos, usually after sunset, with looting and vandalism. But most demonstrations across the nation have been peaceful, diverse, and unifying.
Black people in this country have never had equal protection under the law. Never. When my adult children go out in the streets wearing a hoodie, I don't have any fear for them. But every mother here fears for her children if they're black children, if they're black men in particular. It is wrong. It is unjust.
Instead of resorting to violence, many protesters are instead finding ways to advance the cause of racial justice, like Matt Manning, a Texas attorney who is offering pro bono services to arrested protesters. He wants his sons to see how he used his skills to support the movement.
If you look at the civil rights movement, people did for the movement what they had the best capacity to do. Some people were feeding everybody as they were planning the movement because their contribution was being able to cook for the movement. Other people, you know, preached. Other people did a number of things. And the capacity I serve in as an attorney, I want to make sure that you know, when my days are done, I know I did everything I could to help people. And
others are leaning on their faith.
A time to hope.
Writer Christina Pessoa is calling on her multicultural church congregation to action.
As a believer, really grieves me the most is that in a nation that claims to be Christian, that these things really misrepresent God's character. And, you know, I have two Black boys, and one of the very first things that I taught them about who God is that he is just.
But as nonviolent protesters struggle to reclaim the message of these rallies, many say decades of oppression and frustration has led to this violent moment in American history.
A lot of the issues we see are systemic. These are compounded issues, educational system, the housing system, criminal justice, the disparate outcomes for Black and brown people in this country that have existed since the inception of this country.
Systemic issues that will take time to be resolved. Meanwhile, critics say the image of law enforcement breaking up a peaceful rally outside the White House so that Trump could walk to a church will do nothing to help a community seeking justice and healing. Jason Samelny, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump and Attorney General Bill Barr have blamed the violence in the U.S. on an anti-fascist group called Antifa. But there is limited evidence provided to support those claims. Also, Twitter recently took down posts from a group inciting violence from what it said was a white nationalist group claiming to be Antifa. International Edition's Lori London spoke to Lucia Brooks, spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors extremists and hate groups, to discuss the role of extremists in what is happening in the United States.
The truth of the matter is that this is what far-right extremists do. They exasperate political tensions, take advantage of community chaos, and seek to sow more chaos. That is what they do. They coordinate their efforts to create chaos during protest or any kind of political uprising event. We saw the same thing during the recent protest of shelter-in-place orders. They are attempting to advance the date and time that will bring about society's collapse. It is their hope to sow enough chaos to bring on what they say is the inevitable race war. They've capitalized and they've shown up at the protests and really taking advantage of the Trump administration's long-held desire to tag Antifa as a domestic terrorist threat. When the Department of Homeland Security last year supported the research of the center and other groups that track and monitor extremism, where we know that the threat from far-right extremist groups is the greatest threat to the United States.
Do we know who is causing a lot of this destruction? Is it the people protesting what happened to George Floyd? Is it extremist groups? Is it white nationalists?
It's a combination. As you can imagine, I mean, there are protests all across the country. The Southern Poverty Law Center has seen individuals who we associate with hate and extremist groups at some of these events. Have we caught them in the act of vandalizing or setting a fire? No. That said, they're still there and they agitate and create chaos, as I mentioned before. So they are responsible for some of it. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that protesters, there's so much anger and pain on the part of Black people and people of color and their allies with respect to the continuing anti-Black racism that happens in the country. Sometimes emotions boil over. So I'm not saying that there have not been acts of physical destruction from peaceful protesters. I would say, though, that it's an unfair analogy to compare that to the police violence and the militarization and the extreme use of force that is meeting any physical destruction of property.
Lesia Brooks is the spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center. She was speaking to VOA International Edition host Lori London. The death of George Floyd has renewed calls for law enforcement reform in the United States. It's a topic that's already made its way onto the 2020 election campaign, with presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden telling Black community leaders he would appoint a police oversight board within his first 100 days in office should he win the November general election. Now, to learn more about the history of police reform and the challenges such endeavors face, I spoke to Simone Weichselbaum, national law enforcement reporter for the Marshall Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system.
So in the late 1960s, President Johnson commissioned several investigations, reviews, different commissions were set up, and some big changes to policing came out of that. One was trying to professionalize policing. So the federal government agreed to pay for education, like going to college for police officers. Another one, BIRST, which is a modern day wing of our Justice Department, to start investigating science and research and how to get policing closer to the academy, like working with professors. Some of that is still around today. And in these reports, they found the same problems we have now. Police departments are not diverse. Police departments are too rough when they're dealing with African American communities. And a lot of this also talked about inequality in America, which goes back to slavery.
So for our international audience, mm-hmm. this is a problem that has been going on for hundreds of years. And with efforts in the last few decades to make reforms, can you kind of point to some examples that have been successful?
Well, let's talk about America really quickly in the 70s and 80s. So a lot of the changes I just described helped make police departments diverse. There was a point in history that police departments were really filled with Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants. Police unions helped generation after generation of ethnic white Americans get these jobs. And it was during this time period that policing, because of help with federal money, was able to start hiring women, hiring more African Americans, hiring people who were out as LGBTQ. Like people today, and I study this stuff, but don't really realize how homogeneous policing really was. And you could argue still is. Mm-hmm. So let's get into the mid-90s when the Rodney King incident occurred.
Now, for our international audience, these were a series of riots and protests that erupted in Los Angeles in 1992 following the acquittal of police officers who were captured on tape beating Rodney King.
The reason why I brought up Rodney King, and that's the birth of consent decrees in policing. So after the LA riots, Congress decided, hey, let's have a mechanism that DOJ can come in and force police departments to reform. And out of that came a new law, which is still in place today, which now allows the Justice Department to come in and basically threaten to sue a local city and a local police department and force them into reform.
And as I understand it, it can take years for a police department to complete the plan outlined in that consent decree, perhaps 8, 10, maybe even 15 years. And you have so many different police departments around the United States. Is it a sense of scale in that there aren't enough teams to go out and work with police departments, or not enough organizations to participate in those kinds of endeavors to bring about what some people say is desperately needed?
No, because here I am in New York City. I've covered the NYPD professionally. I grew up here. And this is a department. They have several people with advanced Harvard degrees. Some of my sources went to Harvard, who are police commanders at the NYPD. Several people that I know, again, sources of mine with PhDs, law degrees. The NYPD is one of the most highly educated police departments in the world. The NYPD is usually seen as a model. When I was a graduate school student, we studied the practices of the NYPD. It's supposed to be the creme de la creme of American policing. And they're going out there right now fighting with the protesters. So that is our blue ribbon of policing, which has the brightest minds in policing, which can afford and has worked with the best researchers and professors in policing. And this is what they're doing night after night. I don't know what to say about the rest of our country.
Simone Weichselbaum is the national law enforcement reporter for the Marshall Project. And coming up later, this is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Mars has two tiny moons, Phobos and Deimos.
Scientists from the SETI Institute and Purdue University have written a study that proposes for Dimas to have its strange tilted orbit, Mars had to be circled billions of years ago by a ring like those around the giant planets. While Dimas migrated outward, Phobos is being pulled toward the surface of Mars. It's expected that as Phobos draws nearer to Mars, gravity will break the tiny moon into little pieces that will go on to form a new ring around the red planet. The scientists propose in time those ring segments will reconstitute itself back into a smaller moon. The study author suggests that Mars had generations of moons that would cycle into rings and back to moons. They offer that a ring made from a former moon pushed Dimas on its outward path, and after several moon-to-ring cycles, went on to form Phobos. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Brazil announced Tuesday that it had marked another one-day record of coronavirus deaths. The health ministry said it had confirmed 1,262 COVID-19 deaths, bringing the total to 31,199, with the number of total confirmed cases now at 555,383, second only to the United States, which has more than 1.8 million total cases. Despite the escalating spread of the coronavirus and the growing death toll, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro continues to dismiss the severity of the outbreak as nothing more than a little flu. He told supporters in Brasilia that he regrets each of the deaths, but that's everyone's destiny. According to Johns Hopkins University, the total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases now stands at about 6.4 million cases around the world, with over 380,000 deaths. More than 106,000 confirmed deaths have been recorded in the United States alone. Experts are warning of a possible resurgence of cases in the United States, where thousands have been protesting in the streets against racial violence, ignoring the social distancing warnings and recommendations to wear face masks. A French court will decide today whether Félicien Kabuga, one of Africa's most wanted men, should be handed over to a United Nations tribunal where the former businessman is charged with financing the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Nicolas Pinault has more.
The appeals court in Paris has ruled that Félicien Kabuga can be transferred to the UN's International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals. Kabuga's lawyer said he will not receive a fair trial at the tribunal, which is based in The Hague and in Arusha, Tanzania. They also argue his health is too frail for him to be transferred to the African country, particularly during a dangerous pandemic. But the court said his health was not incompatible with a transfer. I'm Nicolas Pinault for VOA News in Paris.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam arrived in Beijing Wednesday for meetings with central government officials about a planned national security law that could be implemented as soon as later this month. Her visit to the mainland comes a day before the June 4th anniversary of the crackdown on protesters in Tiananmen Square in 1989. Each year, Hong Kong residents observe the anniversary, but this year, the government has banned such gatherings. On the eve of the anniversary, I spoke with local journalist Ria Mogul via WhatsApp to learn how people reacted to that decision and what they're planning to do tomorrow.
Yeah, so, you know, they announced a couple of days ago that for the first time in 30 years, the June 4th vigil in Victoria Park would not go ahead. And of course, they cited the reason for this was because of social distancing and because we're still under social distancing rules. But many people, in fact, all democracy activists and many Hong Kong people believe that this ban is quite political. They see it as a way of clamping down on what they think is an expression of their freedom, of their rights. You know, the organizers of the vigil said that they were confident that Hong Kongers would adhere to social distancing rules and gather in groups of eight in Victoria Park. Now, bear in mind, Victoria Park is huge. It's massive. There's, you know, several football pitches, and it can hold a capacity of, last year there were about 180,000 people. So they were confident that people would camp out in little groups of eight and you know, keep to social distancing rules. And when the announcement came that the march would not be allowed to go ahead at all, people were very angry.
So if people can't meet physically, are they still planning to observe the vigil?
Yeah. So the organizers of the event are still going to gather in Victoria Park in groups of eight, and there's not many organizers. So what they're going to do is they're going to be present at Victoria Park, and they're going to live stream to, you know, whoever wants to join the online vigil, and people will be in their homes and light candles. There's also several pop-up events that I've seen on Facebook for things like readings, literary readings, where people read, Chinese literature and work from activists on the mainland. So there's definitely several events happening around Hong Kong. There's going to be a lot of online activism. And I imagine people will show up to Victoria Park anyway, because we're not banned from going to public places. It's just that you have to be within groups of eight.
Ria Mogul is a reporter living in Hong Kong. As many Americans take to the streets to protest the death of George Floyd, others have taken different approaches. Anthony McGill is the principal clarinetist for the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, and VOA's Adam Phillips has this story on how McGill changed an iconic song to reflect the times.
Anthony McGill's version of America the Beautiful starts quietly, but soon blooms into the familiar hymn-like melody Americans know. Unlike the martial national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, America the Beautiful expresses a vision of bounty, harmony, and freedom for all Americans. But halfway through McGill's version, the tune switches to a mournful mode.
Alongside the beauty and the prosperity and the ability to be free, so many people are still oppressed and being hurt and killed. It's painful. We can't just always be in the major key and think that everything's always all right.
Unlike the normal ending for America the Beautiful, McGill's piece offers no satisfying musical resolution. He rewrote it like that because the brotherhood and beauty described by the song's lyrics remain mostly unrealized.
And then I went down to my knees and put my clarinet and my hands behind my back.
McGill's gesture echoes professional American football player Colin Kaepernick and others taking a knee during the national anthem before games to protest police killings of African Americans. President Donald Trump, among many others in the country, condemned Kaepernick as disrespectful.
Yes, and this caused such a controversy that they had to stop doing that, and he lost his contracts. But really what it was trying to do is bring attention to this terrible evil in the world.
He adds that his kneeling gesture also signifies other things.
It signifies surrender. For some, it signifies an act of prayer. It also signifies a position that we're often in when we're arrested. We have our hands behind our back and we're completely vulnerable.
Today, McGill is the principal clarinetist for the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, the first African-American to hold that position. But he also has tasted the bitterness of racism.
Yes, I've been hassled by cops. I've been hassled by people that work in stores. I've been hassled by security guards. I've been hassled just in minor ways throughout my entire existence. And most of the time you just use humor. You kind of laugh it off almost. But really underlying all of that is always a fear of something bad happening to you, because you see that you can be killed with impunity at any time as a Black person in this country by people that are supposed to protect you.
As a boy, this reality didn't surprise McGill. His father grew up in the southern U.S., where racial segregation and anti-Black violence were everyday facts.
And I grew up knowing about the history, the injustice and death and blood. But traveling around now down there, you realize that there are people doing really great things and progress has come. But then you know that we haven't come that far if people are still being murdered in broad daylight without any recourse. And people are still being jailed disproportionately in communities all over the country. And a majority of those people are Black.
Huge protests continue in almost every major city in America. And while the great majority of demonstrators are peaceful, there has been some arson and looting, along with some police violence. McGill says that for him, orderly protest good faith dialogue, and of course music are the best ways forward. But he understands why many want to express their fury over the death of George Floyd and countless others without restraint. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.